I know. God, I'm so jealous.
That was just an energy drink. I don't think you have anything to be jealous about there. That's just sad necessity.
Just getting wings.
I'm in the mood to be slow and careful. My body's ready for a mountain climb. All of a sudden it will all become lovely. The flower that opens in the morning light.
The year winds down and we approach the holidays. We figure now would be as good a time as any to bring back what is probably the most unique, all-encompassing perspective in all of beer. And we've got Alex Kidd back on the podcast to talk a little bit about the year that was, answer a couple of my personal questions that I've been kind of stewing over, and kind of recap the year a little bit and just end it with a good podcast. So thanks all for taking the time, Alex, to sit down with us.
Thanks, guys. I appreciate you having me back. I didn't tank your numbers last time, so I
yes, our glorious numbers. No. but yeah, I mean, what an odd time, really, to like have had a gap in between when we've last spoke. I feel like, you know, many obvious things, but. Really, just to get right into it, I mean, you mentioned it a few times before we started recording. You are a new father.
That's right.
How's that just been? I'm kind of getting there myself, and like I have a few kids. I just have been a really deadbeat dad to them. getting close to that point for myself, but I'm just really like, you kind of hear the same thing, but something different from everyone in terms of like how it affects their lives. And you were saying something particularly funny before about how it's affected yours.
Right. So I'm a lawyer. That's my real job. And the courts are still closed out here in California. And so like there have been instances where I'm lawyering from home, like on a court call, and I'm like bouncing the child, like my baby in his bouncer while pressing mute, alternating, speaking to the court, just like a chaotic existence. But I'm not going to give you like the platitudes of the new dad speech, you know, like I'm sure there's people who are better at that. I'm only 4 months in, so I don't know if I'm qualified to give it yet, but it has been crazy just relative to, because last year it was different struggles. Like me and my wife, we did IVF and we had a bunch of different struggles like with that, and just spent like tens of thousands of dollars just getting here. So it's like, it feels disingenuous to lay out like complaints, because I'm honestly so thankful and excited. And I would say that I have a unique set of challenges in that I keep stacking plates on my life, and I don't take any away. Like I still like, I do Mulcatour every week. I do a Patreon video every week. Like lawyering, like new clients, went to a new firm. Like it's just like everything to plate just keeps getting higher. So eventually it's going to catch up with me. But it's a blessing. I get to see my baby son nonstop all day, every day, because I work from home. So
what's his name?
Soren.
Unreal. Hell yeah, dude. Very Sean Hillian of you.
But to get right into it from a selfish level.
Sure.
You talk about the plates, you take on and do as much as anybody that I can see from away. Have you developed like techniques, tools, things that you figured out to manage all of that chaos?
Yeah. Basically everything just comes down to slotting. You just know that there's like certain blocks and things just go in the blocks, and what I do is I just keep pushing it until something suffers, essentially. Like I know I can slot this thing here. I have Mulcatour on Thursday nights. I can edit this video on Sunday morning because he gets up at, you know, 6 a.m. and I can, you know, like all these things they kind of contribute to it. It's like, I certainly play less video games. I do less reading, but I still try to write just as much. I still try to contribute, be active, do podcasts like this. Just cause I think that it's important to have an outlet, and I think it'll catch up with you. If all I did was lawyering and be a dad, I don't think that I would be as fulfilled. So it's harder, but it makes it all possible.
Yeah. I think that's like, I think a version of that is what you hear from people like yourself who are good at, who have, or whether that's innate or learned, time management. And it's something me and Matt struggle with in different ways, but equally.
Well, to speak to it directly, you'd say the time blocking thing is something I see everywhere. And I've downloaded apps, I've made spreadsheets, but truly, and I'll get into these little waves where, okay, every Sunday night, I take 2 hours, I sit down and I time block, and then it lasts like 2 weeks or lasts 3 weeks, and then it's gone. How do you maintain the consistency, or do you do it in that way where you set the time aside to lay it all out, or how are you sticking with it?
I just honestly just do everything through through a calendar, like with my wife, and I just like then it's like between the two of us. So it's like I look at it, I'm like, all right, there's a purple block, there's this thing, and they all kind of like cascade. It does it like so. It's like, oh, the nanny is here at this time, so this is even possible to exist outside of the house, or you know, like it's like it's a way for me to visualize. Like I just look and I'm like, where is there not a color block, and then just try and. And I honestly, it's like, it's almost like an IRL, like RPG, where you're just like constantly trying to slot new things into your character to like maximize, like, all right, what can I get to this? Or like, you know, like yesterday, for whatever reason, my depot was done like 40 minutes early. And I was like, oh, I can do a run right now before the nanny has to leave at 4:30, you know, so I go and scramble, get close, like go, just punch that in because you're just like, cause you look on it and you're like, well, I have Mulcator and I'm going to feel like shit after that. Yeah. Like, so you're like, I'm not going to, you know, you just got to like find it and plug it in.
Yeah. I mean, and it scares me. I mean, the thought of like, I know that I'd like, it's almost kind of like thinking about with a kid, it's such an, I have a lot of guilt saying it out loud. I'm interested in having a child for a lot more reasons than this, but like, it's like, would be the ultimate motivator in those senses. Cause there's most of the time you can usually find a way to use that 20 minutes to like, you know, watch half of the new Succession or something instead, which is definitely what I opt to do. Yeah. Because it's hard. There's no one to make the choice but you. And then I guess part of me thinks that like another life form might help the motivation. But I feel like, I don't know. It's just impressive, man. Yeah, it's very impressive. I do want to ask, though, especially because the last time we talked, probably like the majority of the conversation was about improv.
Oh, yeah.
That has to have maybe not been a... Where's that at? I'll just ask straight up.
You mean like, does improv help with parenting, or do I, am I
valid,
trying to get back to improv?
Valid.
Squash improv.
How much of it is it, a part of your life at this moment?
Well, I think that the comedy scene in general has had to adapt largely to Twitch and Discord and other things to find basically wider venues, not in-person venues. We haven't done a Mulcator show since Tampa on like March 9th, like right when everything was shutting down in 2020. We have to say no to so much stuff. I, in particular, because I have the infinite home, there's a lot of stuff I just have to pass on. So it's 2020 is I'm hoping that we get to do more stuff, but also, it's just such a huge ask because it's not only the show itself. It's like the concerns about the Delta Omicron, like whatever like variant is coming out. It's like all of that. And then also just like being away. Like it's taxing on my time and body to like to go to like if I'm gonna go do a sellout show in Milo and just crush, like that's gonna be 5 hour flight. We gotta do sound check on Friday. If the show's on Saturday, we're, you know, going back, we'll probably do pickup stuff. Like that's like straight up 3 days of like just leaving my wife alone so I can go do a live beer show. And it's just a tough sell. Like it has to just be, it's going to be something that I'm going to have to figure out how to slot it. And I haven't figured it out yet. You know, maybe that'll be the plate that falls down, but I hope not because I love doing it and it's a huge part of my life. But, there's only so many blocks. I look at my calendar. There's only so many places you can put it.
For real.
Yeah, I mean, we can maybe talk about it later. I'm sure we're not too far away from creating multiple timelines we can exist in simultaneously. Sorry, metaverse made me forget kind of what I was going to actually ask you. Do you find yourself missing it? That's what I was going to ask.
Oh, hugely, hugely. Mm-hmm. It's been weird. And I think that you guys probably appreciate this as podcast hosts. Like you exist in this unilateral world of interaction where you've unknowingly shared a good amount of time. People are investing like the most demanding art form time-wise, more than a movie, way more than drinking the beer itself or anything like that. Mm-hmm. They're spending time with you and you're just not on the receiving end of their presence. And so like right now, today, Spotify Wrap just came out.
People
are posting their things. And I see both of us mentioned in some people's. I think that's really cool.
I haven't seen them yet, but...
People have been posting them, and you look at the sheer numbers of because I'm
minutes.
The minutes, the episodes, like the it's absolutely humbling that people like when we have to edit those, I hate myself. I every time an improv bit doesn't tag right, or I trail off, or say the wrong word, or reference the wrong movie or video game, I wince. And to think that people give me that much of their time is like it's amazing. And I miss the bilateral aspect. I miss the give and take. Like when you do a live show, you get those breaks or you find the funny moments and you know, like, oh, well, there's heat on that bit. I'm going to keep egging Michael on, or I'm going to pull Steven into this as a character because they're liking it, you know. But like when you're literally zooming, doing improv with no audience and you're not getting any feedback, it's like all you see, like the only thing I see is like, I'm like, all right, the Patreon people aren't quitting and the numbers are going up. That's the only thing I know are enjoying it. And then you see at the end of the year, you're like, okay, this guy listened for 12,000 minutes and you're like, okay, I meant something to like that guy.
Yeah.
You know, but that's, you just never know. Mm-hmm. And I really miss live performance. Not from some like narcissistic, like, yes, laugh at how funny I am. Like, it's just honestly, like, it feels more organic. It's more of an exchange rather than like I'm creating a product.
Totally.
Yeah.
Unilateral is such a great way to say it, because we've kind of talked about it on here. Like, you kind of just talk to this abstract audience as if they're like, they're one thing, and you come here and talk, and then it's like having an interaction in the tap room where somebody's like, hey, when you shared your story about addiction, like I went through that and like it meant the world to me. And you have this whole, you kind of just do it and say it. And you're like, oh, that was a thing that I shared. There's nothing there. And then seeing it in person and getting the feedback loop of like somebody's actually listening to that and it meant something to them. It elevates it to a whole new level. But there's a weirdness in the abstraction that I still, 3 years later, haven't really gotten my head around.
And I think to the point where, like, we're not performers. We don't come from performance. There's not a desire to, in the same way that improv, traditional improv exists in. But I think at this point, like, the idea of even, like, let's say like recording in the tap room when we're open, not even making a thing. We've talked about it. And then both of us are kind of like, seems kind of scary and weird.
And then COVID made that very easy to stop talking about.
I'm not trying to rake it back up, but your podcast is in an interesting lane in that, because there is the improv component. But like you said, I was curious to ask you, just as, like you say, just as someone that does a podcast too, I can literally not picture doing the podcast remotely from Matt. Obviously you guys don't do video, but from the sounds of it, it's Zoom. You guys aren't in the same room, right?
Very rarely. We've had a few recently where we've done it in the same room, and we've done some like Let's Play stuff for Patreon subscribers. But it's way more difficult to do improv and just get the timing and kind of see where someone's going to go. And also, we're doing non-traditional improv because one thing that you get in a lot of improv is scene work and wipes. And so if you aren't like a big comedy nerd, scene work is like you're gesturing, you're doing something, you're establishing a scene, like I'm digging a hole and you go, I found a treasure map, so that they can visualize like what is going on. So not only do we not have that, but we're doing improv in a non-visual medium. So like, every one of your bits have to be character-based, character-driven. They have to pay off through dialogue alone. And they have to be coherent while you're drinking like 7 beers. And like, you know, like to bring them back into tag. And so it is much better to be in the same room. Like I feel like the energy is better. We get better. I don't want to go full Gen Z on you, but like just the vibe, just the energy. It's a mood.
Well, that's why for those exact same reasons. Yeah. Like that's what it is. Like, I just feel like there would be an awkwardness between us. Like there always is to some level with guests, but like with Matt, I think we rely on a lot of body language and stuff probably without even thinking about it. Has that decision to do that just been like, I have obviously not been to LA in a while, but it just seems like California in general is still like pretty tight in terms of restrictions and stuff. Mm-hmm. Or has that just kind of been like you started doing it that way when things were what they were? And then, because there is an obvious trade-off there. So I'm just curious about that decision.
So logistically, the times that we have done it in person, it's kind of special because something has aligned or there's been some reason for it. Simply because, okay, LA is huge. Yeah. We can't do this show sober. So we have huge, like it's like $80 Uber, like each way to get us there.
For real.
That's true.
For three different co-hosts,
yeah,
we all have to meet.
Dude.
Like we all have to meet somewhere and then also you have like, we have to do it like probably in my basement. Cause like my son goes to bed at like he's like a farmer. He goes to bed at like 7 o'clock to
a
he's
farmer
get
minus
up at,
the work.
Yeah. He's got to get up at 5:45 and tackle those ABCs. Like, you know, like it's like a twilight. This guy gets up. So we both have to do it that way and like not wake him up. And I actually polled a lot of people in our Patreon in the audience to see, could you tell? And they said, well, the best thing was like, they're basically like, no, not really. And I was like, oh, thank God.
Hell that's yeah.
Because if it was like a huge difference, then it would be like weighing on my shoulders. Like, oh God, we're giving them a inferior product, you know, or knowingly not doing our best. But I like to think that we are doing a good job, that we're doing good work, and that it's just a challenging medium, and it's not like doing a live show is any easier too, because much of podcast is exposition. If people show up and they think that they're going to get like a stand-up show, like a tight hour that's been workshopped and just fucking ran for 6 months straight, it's not that. There's so much exposition where you're like, oh, and this, you know, like the Luker faucet can do three different type of check pours, and people aren't going to be like, ha, ha, Leko pour, like wiping tears out of their eyes, and he drinks it in one gulp. Oh my God.
And you're so right though about like when you say, I can't remember exactly how you phrased it, but it was so good saying it, you have to kill strictly in a narrative, verbal form.
Right.
And it, by the nature of improv, speaking on your side of things, like it, you, like when you think of perfectly written words for a scene, you think of Aaron Sorkin, who
right.
will kill someone if they change a hey to a hello. Like he's, and say what, think whatever you will about that style, but it's like improv is the antithesis of that. So it seems just like a tough mountain that's all to even attempt to try to do improv comedy and nothing but respect for doing, because like you say, like I don't bring it, I think I only say it kind of deducing from like, I don't know if you guys make a comment on what's in, like, what's that in your room or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise you wouldn't know. The sound is definitely there.
there's also a lot of like really like lazy reactionary type of improv, like where you, like if you don't know where to go or do a move, it'd be like we're gonna go to the pants pooping contest, and then like the other person will give him one of these like. And then, like, the audience will go, ah, ha, ha. It's like you just like a very vaudevillian, two man show, like a reaction sort of thing. Like, yeah, you can't do any of those because, it would be like, oh, we're going to the pants pooping contest. I see you're giving me that disapproving look again.
And the physical comedy is just completely zapped out of it. Yeah, damn.
Another thing that I wanted to underscore, too, not that, like, Milo is some hustling, bustling industry town of starlets trying to make it, but the vast majority of people have never even seen improv comedy. Maybe they've seen Whose Line Is It Anyway, really short form game based comedy, but like unless you're watching like Middle Ditch and Schwartz, or you know people know what stand-up is, they might know what sketch is, they'll probably call it skits.
Yeah,
so the vast majority of people, like, if you're just in, just name any Midwest state that's not Chicago,
right?
Like you're not going to understand, like, oh, they're making this up off the top of their head, or this is the premise of the comedy is on like that lightning fast, like tags and callbacks and stuff. Like, I've read our iTunes reviews. People go like, the skits they write are kind of weird. And you're like, if you think that we wrote all those, those are terrible. Of course. Like if you sat down and wrote
you
those,
think
like,
I'm Sorkin, like, bro. Like,
of course you're there. I'm going to think those are great. So it's like, but you also can't explain that every episode. Because the vast majority
is about to be. Improv-based comedy.
Yeah, so I don't know. It's just another thing. Like, you have to know your audience, and you have to both address their expectations and try and somehow service them, even if they don't know what they want.
Yeah, which I feel like is any level of consumerism, if you count podcasting in that, like, anything, like, that's what it's all about nowadays, because there's just such a glut of everything to choose from that it's like figuring out what people didn't even know they wanted. And I think I'm just probably regurgitating a bastardized version of something Pete has expounded many times. So, but yeah, that's all super interesting perspective as always. I guess to get to something we talked about, I think, before we started recording again, your craft beer and brewing best of your annual contribution to your 10 best of beers list has just came out. And it's not really the 10. If you want to hear about that, I think there's many places you can do that, the list itself. But I'm more curious about like what someone like in your position, which you're just a figure within beer, but not part of anything beyond what you've created yourself. What kind of goes through your mind when, what sort of boxes are you trying to check with those lists? Obviously, like, there's no denying that it's a reflection of your own palate. Like, it doesn't, nothing about it reads hollow or anything. But obviously, like, you know, we all have tendencies to, you know, drink things, like, go back to things we like, and that's not what a list is helpful for. So yeah, rather than continuing to ramble, I'm just curious about what kind of boxes you're trying to check and what goes through your head.
Yeah, I think one of the best ways to do it is to not do the what's expected. Mm-hmm. Like, for example, if you're looking at it like you have a certain quota of style or geographic pandering, or like trying to service some brewery that was nice to you, like you're doling out some plum.
Exactly.
That's the worst possible way to create one of those lists, because people can tell when you're being disgenuous. You know, like if they listen to
you
me
can smell
all
it
year,
from a mile away
for sure.
Yeah, like if all of a sudden it's populated with like a bunch of like stone beers or like, you know, like stuff, some of people are like, he doesn't drink any of that. Like it's just like I think that I pick things that are either endemic of doing the best version of something, or they're doing something that signifies a shift in beer culture, or it's worthy of comment as a result of creating like a culture or interest. Like for example, like if my list was just nothing but like Marvel movies, you know, you would be like, did this guy see any other types of movies this year?
Yeah.
You know? And you know, like somebody called me out and they said, oh, you know, DDB puts a dark check logger, just trying to just pander. And it's like, no, I enjoyed it that much. And it's like, sure. Are dark check lagers as common as hazies or barrel aged stouts? No. And I think that to be exceptional, to get on a list like that, you have to do something so well that I'm like, I still think about it. I still think about like, how, why do I care about this dark check lager?
Yeah.
More than I do innumerable other barrel aged beers that sell for $500 secondary that all have a 4.7 on Untappd. You know, how does a humble 4.0 bottom fermented multi little gem like compete against those globally? Like I drink about 600 different beers a year. And so some of them are going to rise to the top, but, let's say 15 of those are dark check lagers, not a ton,
yeah.
You know, and just there's not a lot made and you have to actively seek them out. But that's something I wanted to comment on because I found myself caring more about them. And I've like, it's my list. It's not prescriptive. It's not saying that this beer is better than all of the other beers. It's relative to what I had and what I care about. There's certainly things that people enjoy that I think are not good. I did not like Weldberg Starry Noche and I gave up over $600 worth of stuff for it.
Yeah.
Like I would be the one who would be like, oh no, it was good to validate, you know, like the cost sunk fallacy as it is. But no, it was not good to me. I don't like stuff like that. And, I just like to take it to like ruminate on things that I felt were important. And if you're in the shower and you think like, what was that one beer I had? Oh, it was a weird Fantôme with Swedish spices. Like I care about that. The vast majority of people will not care about that, but they don't get to write lists. Me and Stan Hieronymus do. So they can suck it.
Suck it.
Do you feel that the natural urge to kind of do the antithesis of what you said at the beginning of like spread out geography and spread yeah. out style. It's hard to think that that wouldn't be a natural inclination. You know what I mean?
It is because, you know, no matter what the list says or what it is, you're going to be accused of pandering, homerism. Like if I like a beer from Seattle, like a place 950 miles away, they'll be like, typical West Coast bias. And I'm like, no, Floodland is just good. They're like, nah, I've never had it, but I can tell. You know, like, it certainly is because you don't want to look myopic in your own reach because that makes you look as though you didn't go anywhere. Mm-hmm. You didn't do anything.
Makes you look like you shouldn't be there with Stan Hieronymus.
Yeah. You gotta really like pump those numbers up to get into the published author Cicerone realm. So, I think that is that, you know, when I was looking back on it, thankfully the dispersion pretty organically happens, but there wasn't an instance where I was like, oh, I have Jester King and Live Oak. I better kick one of them off. Like I would just, nothing like that happened. It just, the dispersion kind of broke down in that way. There are instances where I would be like, oh, like the, you know, I really love Mikkelhenny and it's a commentary on the past becoming new, mm-hmm. Phoenix rising from like corporate acquisition. Like there's so many things that represents to me, but then I'm thinking like, that's like a California brewery. Like that's San Diego. Like how fair would it be for me to nerf them and punish like a fantastic beer because they happen to make it like 110 miles from where I live?
Yeah.
You know, it's just like, it's as capricious as grouping them together as it is like spreading them apart.
Totally.
And no matter what, like people are going to see that list and the vast majority of people don't get like 10 boxes a week to try stuff. So they're going to go, I can't believe he left off Schticktreak Bankersons. What? Have you never even visited Nebraska? And like, you'll be like, you know, like there's going to be a million of those.
Yeah,
and you just
go,
I just can't like.
On that same, just a quick question, like where does the majority of non-traded for beer that you receive come from? Is it breweries? Is it fans? Who's sending you that?
A lot of it is breweries themselves. I think they want to throw their hat in the ring and, let me clarify this. It's production side people at breweries. The HR and PR people, they do not give a fuck about me. I don't match up with like their organic reach. They don't know what I'm doing. Their PR companies are usually like absolute trash. The emails are like, for immediate release, I hope this email finds you well. Like letting you know in 12 packs, like Redhead Rye, like is cut. And you're like, then you'll ask them, you'll go, like, have you tried this? The PR company doesn't give a shit. They don't know.
Yeah.
And like they have no skin in the game. If None. The beer is bad, like whatever. Their job is to get it in mailboxes and hopefully get it mentioned, or maybe do some brazen like product for mention type of stuff.
Yeah.
You're always getting paid in exposure, and you're like, they're doing you a favor by allowing you to like put it on an Instagram story and have 30,000 people see their product. And like that's the tone of all of it. So understand, the vast majority of stuff is sometimes not even sanctioned by the brewery themselves. They'll be like, hey, I'm a keg washer at this place, and I really like the Dortmunder that we did. And so they'll send stuff. It's not like the head brewer, because maybe they don't even know who I am either.
Yeah.
So like the people who care about me, there's a few people who care about me a lot. It's not a lot of people who care about me at all. Those few people are the ones who are usually low on the totem pole, or they're a regular at a place and they'll just go out of pocket and they'll send me something. Like that's why you see, I try and post the notes. People will put handwritten notes in a lot of these things. They're not, the opposite that is like, I would say like the full pint. The full pint will get like a case from Stone with sell sheets or something. You know, like this is what's coming out, and that's a different model. So that's kind of like where I sit, and honestly, that's kind of where I want to be. I don't think that what I do is palatable or will make sense to like a lot of those places. Like if you're making 30,000, 50,000 barrels a year and you see what I'm doing, they're like, why would we give something to you that you could potentially trash as like one of the largest like beer media outlets on, you know, Instagram or,
totally.
Or whatever else? Why would we take that risk? Like, so the answer to your question is it's kind of everything.
Mm-hmm.
Like, but the one commonality is it's usually people that shouldn't be taking money out of their pocket to send me mm-hmm. anything. It's almost always someone, normal people or normal brewers or normal people that just are like, I want him to try this. And that's I really,
you said the
that.
Come out of pocket thing. So will you have instances where like a non-brewery worker who follows you and loves beer, they're the customer of beer and the real fervent one, sends beer to you because they want you to try something that they're incredibly excited about? Is that part of the influx?
100%. Whenever I can, I always say like, let me Venmo you. Let me like PayPal you, or let me do this. And some brewery employees will be like, no, like I don't want that because I want it to seem like I forced you or like I, you know, and those instances, like I feel bad. And then it's like the recourse is like, well, do I try and on my own end, like put together thank you boxes? And I get in my head about it, like where I'm like, am I just on the receiving end now? Mm-hmm. Like, on the basis of inertia from what I'm created, am I writing a decade's worth of work and now just like coasting? Because that doesn't seem right either, to not pay goodwill back into the community.
Yeah.
And it's like, so like last year I did the BLM, fundraiser, but then it's like, well, how does this benefit the people in the beer community? And then I'm like actively, it's just like, I constantly think about these things because I don't want to seem like entitled or my hand is out and I'm just like, send me it and I'll hammer out my 500 words for you peasants. Cause like, There is like an imbalance because it's like on paper, you're like, this guy is like a lawyer in Santa Monica, like, and he gets this much beer. Like, why should I give this guy anything? Why should I fucking pay for a Patreon for him? Like, why should it, you know, like, and so I constantly am like, I have to be spending all of this Patreon money like on Malkator. It has to be like the next craziest stunt. I got to rent a Ferrari. I got to buy a bottle of Salil du Minuet. Like I'm constantly like, if I'm not spending it and I'm using this to like enrich myself, then like that's not right. That's fucked up.
Incredible.
Yeah, there was so much there. I lost the train a little bit, but like,
that was
awesome, man. There's just a lot to chew on there. I guess first and foremost, I do want to point out that I think it really, guilt is what I literally eat for breakfast every morning. Guiltaholic. So I get the feeling completely. But it, to me, it just speaks to like, your opinion is trusted and valued because you've taken the rights you've, whatever examples of kind of like alternative ways to be exist in this community.
You're about to get canceled. you're gonna say selfie based promotion. I know that's what you're doing.
Thanks for saving me there. I just really think it speaks to your integrity, intentional or not, mm-hmm. and I don't want that to go unsaid.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but I deal with a lot of things where like I've rebelled against the feeling I'm feeling because it doesn't feel good. And then when I can get a moment of clarity and look around it, it's like that guilt is what leads to the good decisions that earns the trust mm-hmm. from the people that brings things to you that then feeds more guilt that then continues to make you make the right decisions. And they're these brutal cycles. But when I can find a moment of clarity, it's like, oh, this anxiety or this insecurity or this thing, this is the driver of why I can be okay. And I can never hold on to those moments for very long. I'm back to being in the guilt or the things you guys are talking about. But that was listening to you say it. It was like the unlock of like, that's why he is what he is. That's why he's amazing. Cause he doesn't take that money and you know what I mean? You want to put it back in. To me, it's so clearly like macro like that.
Yeah.
But I liked hearing you say it.
Yeah. I do want to ask just cause you kind of made me think about it and it might actually be a good transition into the next thing we wanted to talk about. But I don't have TikTok. What I see is all through Instagram, mm-hmm. but I kind of understand, like, there's a part of me that's very interested in the concept of like the Jake Paul type of, not minus the boxing, but like, how are these like cliques, like these houses of, and all they do is make stupid videos. And I'm not even really hating on it. It's like, you can't hate on something that popular. It's absolute fool's errand. Yeah. But I'm intrigued because I don't understand it at all. But I know there was that, I only know it because he was on Theo Vaughn's podcast, but it was some guy kind of in that world. There was some kind of group video thing and he got like flung into a crane. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I think so.
It was like Jeff something. Anyway, he got really injured in stunts though. It was all, the whole point of what I'm saying is they had to raise the bar higher and higher on a much bigger kind of level of what you were talking about with the Patreon mm-hmm. with the Ferrari mm-hmm. or I don't even know what the fuck that I'm assuming beer you mentioned was, but how are you handling like controlling that?
Well, so it's always like, okay, first of all, you have to justify what the bit is and justify like, what is it a commentary on? Because if it's just spectacle, you're literally a TikTok person. Mm-hmm. Like if you're just spending money like on like sealed Pokemon boxes and shit, like then all it is flex culture. And if what you're creating is flex culture for like people who are like shift brewers who make like $12 an hour, you're a fucking asshole. Like that's why like it's like, okay, I like, for example, like people make fun of like the way that I dress. There are certain clothes that I buy that I'm interested in. I research justifiably. It is not relatable. It's fucking ridiculous shit. But like, I think what I like to do is like take a part of it and like ridicule it or examine it or, mm-hmm. you know, like turn a lens on it. So, in terms of like the feeling of the next biggest thing and how do we do it? I just always think, first of all, like what are we saying and who is it punching out at or what's the bit about? Mm-hmm. And, like once you can justify that, you can color in the lines, to make the funny and define like what it is. Like for example, at one of our live shows at Paso Robles, I had this idea, as a commentary on, oh, no, no, here's a perfect example. Okay. So recently I made a micro blotter, like acid tabs of bourbon. And to do this, I had to spend like hundreds of dollars on like an ounce of bourbon. And then I had to buy the tabs and do all this stuff. And so I was like, well, okay, to justify this, like here, I'm just going to show you how the bit is made. Like it's a commentary on people not opening their things or things becoming so valuable that the only viable way is to effectively like through socialism, like crowdsource an enjoyment. Like you, like bottles of beer get so expensive that you have to split them 11 ways so that you denature the ability to even enjoy it because the pores are so small.
Yeah.
Or like with bourbon, it's just never even going to get opened at all. And so like, it's not that like you're actually going to taste that bourbon. It's that it's been so denatured and ruined. The experience from whatever like greatness was created is so ridiculous that like the funniest way is to give everyone a non-experience. Like simultaneously. So we sent out like 106 of those tabs. And that's a commentary that's like punching upwards at people who collect bourbon and don't open it. People who like sit on bottles until they're worse so that they're worth more. Just every variant on that. So like that's like a perfect example of how you like crafted like that bit was made.
And the comfort to go big and push that way when it's grounded in a real meaning or making a real statement.
Right. Yeah. Versus if it was me buying a $500 like vial of bourbon and like gloating about it or just like to talking about like how exclusive and inaccessible it is, like you would get, that's basically a lot of like the bourbon review paid editorial content. Like a lot of the bourbon review scene is just like either straight up, it comes from a distillery. They give them talking points. They like the samples are provided. No, nobody's out there like shelling out tens of thousands of dollars every year to source their own bottles of like Michter's 20 and, you know, like they're just like, they're not doing that because they don't have. There's bourbon meme pages, but like, I don't think that there's like a comparable like bourbon DDB.
Don't drink bourbon.
Don't drink bourbon. Who's just like in the fucking red massively, like buying all these bottles and giving an honest impression. Like, no way.
There's not a venture capitalist in the world that'll fund that endeavor. Well, I want to ask you something while you're kind of honing on that thing. Because to me, there's a juxtaposition to you that's incredibly interesting, that is a person who cares incredibly about beer culture over a very extended period of time and hasn't really succumbed. And maybe this is putting words on you. I'll let you kind of answer yourself, but it doesn't seem like you've hit a ton of that burnout or had burned out on the thing that you're so interested in. While at the same time, you've turned a mirror at it. You've made fun of all the ridiculous parts of it. And you've done that without burning out on the culture as a whole. And holding that juxtaposition in place is incredibly interesting to me. Could you expound on that a little bit?
Yeah, I think part of just the longevity of it is essentially it's a series of like interrelated projects. Like, it's not like Don't Drink Beer. You could look at it as a series of islands of just little things that I want to do, like the YouTube videos, like with the, you know, this guy, like that guy is like one little island. There's like the written reviews. There's this. And, you know, some people like rolled their eyes and groaned like when I was an early adopter and got on TikTok and tried making content there, because they're like, oh, he's trying to be an actor. He's trying to put his face really out there now. And it's like, no, I'm just constantly trying to evolve and try new things. And there's times like when I don't do that good and I fail. So that's like the key to longevity is always make sure it's fun and that you care and that it never feels like a chore. Mm-hmm. Now in terms of like not poisoning the well and like losing a fan base or like just being so toxic that like you're no longer funny, you're not like the jester of a scene, you are just a curmudgeon or you're out of touch or anything. I think a lot of that just comes from like finding like what is worthy of ridicule and what is just like a product of like people doing their best, you know, like And it's a fine line because, you know, things you could make fun of probably 5 years ago in the scene, like now you couldn't. And, you know, it always is changing. Like 5 years ago, it would be like high comedy to be like, oh, just make fun of macros, you know, just make fun of anybody who gets bought out. Yeah. Or like, you know, and it's just like, it was like a tired refrain. It's like, you're not really saying anything. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, you're punching upwards at companies, but you're not like, you're not really commenting on the state of things on like a granular level. So to remain relevant, you have to just like know that there's people that still enjoy it. You have to still enjoy it yourself, and so that you are in fact relatable, and make things that people identify within themselves, like harnessing my own insecurities and making them into punchlines it's a way of like both saying like, I am a part of this culture. These are my own shortcomings. If you share them, like, please laugh at me as well.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and I think also just to one last thing, I think kind of what Matt, that was a much better answer than I could have hoped for. But I think what Matt was kind of asking was like, what you had mentioned is making sure that you still enjoy it yourself. And I think, yeah. I'm sure people handle that in a lot of different ways, but it's not an uncommon trajectory at all to become very burned out on beer when you're that into it, especially like when you're spending a lot of your time examining and creating satire out of the increasing number of absurd parts about the industry that make it foreign from what inevitably it kind of was that got you interested in it to begin with, probably. Mm-hmm. I think that's changing now. Like if a new DDB came, they would have been coming. I don't know how they would be inspired, yeah, to want to do that. But so yeah, like how has that been for you? Have you had to actively work on like continuing to like beer? I know that sounds stupid, but I mean, I have to work on it.
Yeah, I don't think that's stupid at all. I think that curiosity and that interest is really what creates like any sort of creative endeavor. If it starts feeling rote and you're just an adjective randomizer, then you're failing the people that used to like what you do. And to write 3,500 reviews about like fermented sugar water and to still try and make them crackle and pop with imagery, like on the, you know, the 100th hazy IPA review, you know, and like you have to care about like the distinctions in what's being made, why, you know, what, how is it different from things that you've had? And like also like on a more like bird's eye level, like is this changing the industry or, you know, like what type of consumer is buying this? I think all of those things, when you put them together, like that's how you get something that's like memorable. And if somebody wants to be the next DDB, like, please, like, it's fine.
I got too many plates, man.
I need one. I need a plate gone.
Like, yeah. So, yeah, I do think that is important though. Like examining, like if you're still having fun and if you still enjoy beer, and not just, taking anything for granted or like looking at boxes from a brewery you've never had and then just immediately rolling your eyes at the, oh my God, a blueberry slushy sour. And like, you know, like not being excited about what you're doing because it is like such a privilege. Like so few people get to make anything. Like in a world with so many voices, like to be listened to, like in any way, is a privilege, let alone 12,000, whatever podcast minutes or anything like that. So like if somebody's not having fun or if they don't want to be there, then you shouldn't show up. Don't like watch DDB Instagram stories. If you're like, oh man, he clearly is phoning it in. Or like this review was just, you know, did he even try the beer? Like at that point, you justifiably would be like, I'm just going to go somewhere else.
Yeah.
Beyond it being a privilege, like it's inevitably a burden in terms of like, because there's almost in how things exist now, you're expected to continue to consume a wide variety of beer, think thoughtfully about it, and be able to channel that into the multiple forms you do. Obviously, you're a human with free will and you could stop doing that at any time. But do you have like, do you ever have to switch to wine for a while or like, I don't know, something to distance makes the heart grow fonder kind of thing?
Yeah. Yeah. I think that palate recharge is great. Especially for more nuanced stuff. If you're drinking like 3 or 4 days back to back, you get this fatigue.
Yeah.
Like even with enough sleep, like, and, it's just like, it's too much of a good thing. You know, like if it happens at tastings, it happens in life. And, you wonder like, are there some circumstantial or like other factors that like a brewery didn't get a fair shake because I was tired or that, you know, like I try and make sure that it's as fair as possible. But again, I'm only one person doing all of this, like trying to make sure that it's consistent and your palate changes also over the years as well. So something that you bombed on 5 years ago, you might love now.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I do like, my wife drinks exclusively like Rhone. She loves like, you know, Higandas, like Chateauneuf du Pape, like all of that region. And so like, I find that that's like a great go-to, just to take a night off of beer. I obviously drink bourbon. I make cocktails. And then sometimes shockingly, I'll just drink like sparkling water and have a bag of like peanut M&Ms or something and just be like, I'm just going to chill tonight. Yeah. And watch some trash TV, just because otherwise, like you get burned out and you like roll your eyes and you go another one of these, another like attempt at a vanilla coconut barrel aged imperial stout. Like how predictable, you know, you get jaded.
Yeah. You become Steven Tyler. But it really is so true though. I mean, and I'm not kidding when I say I'm constantly trying to work at it. And I think, for different reasons, certainly. But I mean, this is kind of my bed. Like I own this company. I need to be interested in beer. And can, you know, I need to find that spark no matter how I'm doing it. Because this is, there's other people depending on me for it. It's an interesting thing to almost start to resent the thing that you love so much. You built a part of your life around it, you know?
Well, you can become like your own cliche, like, because let's say in Bissell has a capacity to affect the market itself. And so if there's like people that like respect your innovation and then they want to benchmark Swish and like, and then there's 50 like Swish-esque things in like markets, like suddenly the people who are reviewing Swish for the first time, not realizing that it itself is like the progenitor of whatever that, the unmoved mover was, they'll go, but you know, I'll buy the numbers crossover West Coast hazy IPA sort of thing. And like when I'm writing reviews, I find myself like, and this is not like me pulling out my shoulder, like patting myself on the back, but like there's like a certain degree of like phrases, adjectives, things that I feel like if I've used, they'll seep into like mainstream untapped. And like now that's totally a hack. That's a hack adjective. That's a hack, like, you know, like, oh, he's describing like a hazy IPA, like with grapefruit or tangerine, like, oh, like, you know? And so you're like, oh man, am I going to crib like my own perception of this to like go for some like Buddha's hand and yuzu, you know, like just to not be using the cliche.
Just to not like, make adjectives. It functional.
Yeah. You're just like all like, because there's only so many adjectives that are going to be in the sensory realm for beer. And so like, if you see me like talking about like, oh, it's like a, you know, a cardigan out of the dryer, people be like, no, this guy tastes cardigans out of the dryer. It's like, no, I just don't have any more fucking words because you guys took them all. Like not in reality, but it's like, you have to continue to innovate because otherwise it's just like they don't need to read your stuff anymore. Yeah. They're like, oh, I know the adjectives he uses to describe West Coast IPAs. Like, I get it.
Yeah. He's written 3,500 reviews. Like how many, real quick, how many roughly, cause you know, kind of how, what probably your average word count is. How many words is that?
It really depends on like the era. So early on with the narrative would add a lot. Like for those of you who don't know, like don'tdrinkbeer.com is a website. And that one, like if you go to the back archives from like 2010 and 2011, the early ones will have a narrative that's supposed to encapsulate like the idea, the joie de vivre of the beer. And those ones are longer. Those are like 700 to 900 words. And then in the modern era, like I have to figure out a way to comply with 2200 characters, which usually shakes out to be about like 370 words. Mm-hmm. So there's some things I can't explore. And honestly, even that to some people is like, it's a tall task to get people to read it all. They're not going to a website anymore. Like they're not, that's dead as disco. Like, so even getting them to read an Instagram caption, like if you're asking 370 words with people's attention span now, like TikTok has decimated that into like a 7 second like video with no reading, like
and no meaning.
It's a no, like yeah, it's a very tall order to like ask someone to do that. So now it hovers around that. And you know, I find that sometimes the imagery suffers, or if I want to do like something with a more overarching thing, you just can't. You gotta cram it in, and like those are just the guidelines. And if people take the time to read that, then great. I'm super grateful.
Huh. Hmm. Well, I wanna go there for a little bit in terms of kind of the way technology has moved things, the way things are going, and you to me have clearly shown a willingness to go play in those places. Frankly, I look at it as being pretty fearless. You talked about it before, like doing a TikTok that could absolutely flop. It could be ridiculous. It could be stupid. But in that fearlessness come the great things that come with it, the understanding of the space, the understanding of how to utilize the medium in the correct way and all of that. Mm-hmm. So what I really want to talk to you about that I'm incredibly interested in is things like the metaverse, NFTs. I'm a huge proponent for crypto and those things, and I believe in it in this big, like, justified
in the air
way.
Crypto
of, yeah, I believe in it in all those ways. Before we unpack in all of that place, though, I would be very curious about your opinion, just in general, about what COVID has done to the state of society and their willingness to kind of live online and live in these places. I certainly think there's been an acceleration. I think COVID has accelerated the speed at which all of these things are going to come to us. Just from somebody who views it all and looks in, what do you think COVID has done to the state of the beer market and where people are living and willing to live?
I think that, you know, it really was kind of such a strange experiment because so much of beer is usually predicated on like social interaction. Mm-hmm. A lot of small places are just pints in hands, asses in seats. 70% of margins are just straight from the tap. So when you took that away and you got to shipping and it's like this abstraction, like, are these beers as good in my house watching Vanderpump Rules? You know, like you start like really like examining whether or not the beer was that fun or that good, like in general. And so people started to question like their value subsets, and certain beers like skyrocketed and became worth like way more money. And then a lot of beers kind of just plummeted and fell, like in the way that like NFTs have an abstracted value that is based on like intersocial agreement. Mm-hmm. People were just like, you know, I don't need this. Or, you know, now that anything can be shipped, like I can get a case of Monkish just by doing nothing. Like the concept of like the value of the things like that were sought after that previously would entail like a DMV style line in the cold or things like that. I think that people kind of like reassessed like what it was that they cared about in the beer world. You saw a lot of like reversion just to lagers, what's easier. I mean, also too, like just crazy regression in all like luxury collectibles, like trading card markets to, you know, to cars, to everything that was potentially collectible. People were scrambling and reaching out in loneliness to try and find some sort of thing that would fill that, that idea of value. Certainly I bought more ridiculous clothes. Like I bought beers that I previously would never buy because I wanted to figure out a way to make them relevant or make something that got me a serotonin drip of attention or something. I don't know.
That's incredibly interesting. I haven't go there a tiny bit further when you say why. If I'm looking linearly at like your ability to go out and kind of flex in person or like social status show or do anything in person kind of comes off the table a little bit. Because the data is there that luxury items and a lot of these things went nuts. What do you think that speaks exactly to? Like, what need was being replaced?
I think that, like, first of all, people just, a lot of their social interactions, their vacations, like these organic experiences had been removed from previously. So like some people had excess money laying around and literally nothing to do with it. And they're chasing like this concept of fulfillment. And that's why it's no coincidence that so much of it is like sports card memorabilia and things that are like very like regressive or back to like childhood wants and desires and things like that. Like 90s sports cars, Acura Integras, and like all of those are so expensive now. Like, the Toyota Supra is like $130,000. Like, it's all these people that are like, you know, in the absence of like sitting in a pub and having like a pint of beer and having that structured the experience. It's like, well, what can I get that's like so good? What's like the best thing? And like with the bourbon market, you see people just consolidating. Like they're buying up anything that's potentially collectible. Like even things that are like eagle rare.
Yeah, I was just going to say like, I heard a guy talking about it yesterday.
Yeah. Yeah. You're like, and like, if I take 10 eagle rares and I consolidate them, I can get this one bottle. And like, you know, to get this idea of like possession is the value, like to have like dominion over this thing is like, I have value because I possess a thing that is desired. Like, so ipso facto, like I'm a desirable person. I know what this thing is. I have it. Other people want it. Like, it's a weird, like transference of cachet.
Yeah.
Like it's not like wearing cool clothes out in public or something like that. But it is like very much like the same type of thing, because the only people who care about it are the people who want it, and the feedback loop, it goes up $10 every auction because that person wants to be the next person who's the, you know, I don't know. It's just it's a series of people like on a blue dot, like seeking validation in strange ways in isolation. And we're all just manifesting little versions of it.
Let's go there as it relates to beer. Cause I'll be the, I have like, I got into Bitcoin like wicked early, didn't have the attention span, in and out. Yeah. I've never hit like any of the big licks. So like I had, the first time I had Bitcoin,
like, are you doing this show?
I had a few of them at like $200, but I did this weird thing when I'd miss a lick, then I kind of rebelled against the whole thing in general. You know what I mean? Cause fuck me, I can't be that wrong. And then when NFTs came, I wasn't very early to that space. So I did the old man hating those things. And then I kind of checked myself and like, wait, you're doing it again. This is why you missed this stuff.
Yeah.
And when I really dove into it hard for like 2 weeks, I truly had like the aha moment of like, oh my God, like, I started to get the first use case and then the second. And then it's like you go buy a house and you're like getting like these photocopied documents from all over the fucking, are you, it's 2022. Are you kidding me? Like everything in the home buying process should be on the blockchain and should be an NFT. And as all of that kind of settled in, I got to this weird place where I could see it in so many places, but I don't personally see it very well in beer. And I just, to what you speak about, like in collectible clothing and the shoe sneaker industry and stuff like that, where value is so closely tied to the thing, it makes a ton of sense. And you see Nike already moving, you see everybody moving there. Where do you personally see this fitting into beer? Because for some reason, I just don't see it not being gimmicky, or like, where can it really provide value?
Well, first of all, we have to separate out like these sort of luxury items, like from things that are consumable versus things that just are things that people want to possess. Mm-hmm. Like, yes, a car is consumable in a certain way. Shoes are meant to be worn and used up. But when you really get to like discreetly consumable like items like cigars and wine and beer and bourbons and things like that, like it's interesting because it's long been known that you're transcending like the return on investment. People aren't buying these things to drink them, or they're not buying them to enjoy them. It's a placeholder for value of some mm-hmm. kind. Now, usually the reason you can get people to like, you know, get suckered in and like put money into the outside market, like for secondary sales, is because they feel like they're missing the boat. Either they're never going to be able to try this, the ship's leaving the station. Like the people who are just entry level want the experience of trying Pappy Van Winkle before it becomes even crazier, you know? So maybe they get in like with the hopes of actually like using it for its intended purpose. Mm-hmm. But everyone who's at the top of this like MLM, like has no intention. They've had it. And then they laugh at anybody who actually opens it. So in terms of beer, what you're seeing is like this idea of like exclusivity and inaccessibility is really crumbling away with competitors, local options, and also like people having tried all these things, like realize that these items for to a large part are interchangeable. And also beer is a far more like fragile, like non-enduring item. It has a moment in time, and it doesn't have the benefits of like something like bourbon or wine where it can hold up for that long. Mm-hmm. So all of these like liquid assets, badum tish, like have a window of enjoyment that like, if you've ever seen a video of somebody who held on to like mint Jordans from the early 90s and like you get that the heel just falls apart like in your hands, like it looks like cake, like that is essentially like the beer industry in itself. Like I've spent so much money chasing things. Like I spent like $350 a couple months ago on a bottle of Allagash Gargamel, and like we open it and both of my co-hosts are like, why the fuck did we waste all this money on this wild ale from 2009? And I was like, this is why. I want to like prove a point about like the enduring nature of like what you're seeking and what you're missing out on by not pursuing like the present. Yeah. And like the long story to what I'm saying is because it's not as enduring, because there's a more of a proliferation of comparable market comps that you can mm-hmm. go to, I see the value of secondary falling with the exception of a few like discrete things that just skyrocket because it doesn't matter what's in the bottle. It's literally just a placeholding.
Yeah.
Like Don Quixote is going to continue to just rise because it's just known as Don Quixote, and the people, this is just like the art world too. The way that Sotheby's and Christie's manipulate the shit out of the fine art world by making sure that nobody else can buy in. Those fucking Lambic guys who are at like the top who have those sellers, like if you think that there's not a degree of collusion for every comp or like making sure that like someone doesn't like lose it in a fire sale. Like it's exactly like what happened with like all of the Warhols. Like none of those bottles sell in some like random fire sale because they're all scooped up, bought by the same like cadre of like people. Yeah. Those bottles never fall. Those are not going to fall. But like every other version of these things that we see, like the perpetually cheaper Dark Lord variants, the perpetually cheaper Toppling Goliath KBBS, like those are all going to slide because like you can only prey on people's like insecurities or desire for the unknown for so long until like it settles.
Damn.
Yeah. I'll ask this just as someone again that I'm not like a lot of things that we've talked about are not something I'm involved in, but very curious about kind of on the sidelines and just the secondary market of really anything. I'll buy stuff on eBay, but I'm not a sneakerhead. There's just not, I'm collecting really. Mm-hmm. So I'm for someone like where Toppling Goliath was selling bottles that were like 600, about as expensive as beer can be.
Right.
I'm curious if you think someone like that started at such a high apex, or not started, but sort of like is coming into this next era at such a high place, if it's like the higher, the harder they fall type of thing, or if that actually just buys you more time of remaining the exclusive, of having the idea of exclusivity and like premiereness.
Yeah, I think that it gives you a series of like arrows in your quiver that you can use to leverage. Like, you can still have event days that are predicated around this, and like they control the output. They can control how much remains on site. Like, there's a lot of stout purveyors who are masters at this, like to make on-site only bottles for perceived scarcity, perceived rarity. And really that's just keying into people's like idea of like an organic, like valuable, like Gen Z, like experience based, like validity. And so it's not going to like be, you're not going to see like KBBS in four packs, like at a Wegmans or something, but like, it'll still have a cachet, but really like the things that are hands off, the people driving the secondary sales aren't going to go as crazy because people have already had it, or they'll already be sitting on bottles and things like that. Which is good. It's good that people try these things and that the market settles for these types of items, because what it gives the brewery the chance to do is that thing is still desired. Like, it's still sitting on like the Beer Advocate, like top 100. I think it's still like number one or something, because it's got a legacy of reviews. And what you end up doing is you're able to give someone an experience that is like, that makes them feel good without the premium. Mm. Like the water leaves and then all the boats are just sitting there, but it's still good to somebody who's never had it. It's still like an organic and interesting experience to like, if you ever give someone who doesn't give a shit about Heady Topper their first time, like they love it. They lose their mind. Maybe they've heard of it. And to you, it's like nothing. Mm-hmm. Like, you're like, who gives a shit? Like, this, you know, it's not Fittins or like whatever the new hottest like Hazemaster is, but it democratizes the quality by like leveraging these like past legacies. It makes people who want to make these beers copy them and make them better. It makes like the 50 different Swish copycats have to make themselves better. And so these benchmarks, as stupid as they are for the people who came in, like preyed upon anybody with a wallet to hit the secondary sales, it makes beer better in general down the line. Assuming you don't get in like an Alpine Green Flash situation where you have like, you know, like terrible six packs of Nelson and Hoppy Birthday in, you know, like out of the cooler on the ground at BevMo and stuff. Not that. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about like them using pre-existing, like Lost Abbey re-releasing Cable Car Creek. You know, it's a different beer, but like, it's a lever that they get to pull, and like people get excited, and you know, maybe they go in and they try something else that Lost Abbey has on, or it gives them a new interest in a brand that is worthy of their attention over and above, in my opinion, something like 450 North or some people that perhaps they are like a puree driven type of like brewery. I'm here for it because it's ultimately going to make better educated consumers and people are going to be happier.
Hoorah.
Excellent. Yeah, excellent. Did you have anything else, man?
Nope. Next year, when we do this again, sometime around Christmas, we'll circle back. We'll see if we'll be doing this in the metaverse.
When they finally, in person.
Who knows?
Just when the CDC's finally just given up, and every new COVID variant just called the demon variant, demon 1, 2, 3, and just like, let's get it over with.
And I'm like, oh God, toddlers, you guys, these robot nannies.
But you know the drill. You have done this before. Before we do let you get back to parenting and Noah get back to his turbid mash and his spontaneous beer,
we've got
a three bay to do real quick.
Ooh.
I think we touched on it before, how important improv was to the first podcast. Touched on it again. You don't get to do it in its truest sense as much as you used to. Mm. So I think we've got a good one queued up for you. Let's do three improv comedies. I'll let Noah give them to you. And let's pair them with three of the beers that were on your best in beer list. And
sure.
Then tell us why.
Or I'd say your choice of either that or three beers you had in the last year. I don't know how good your mental Rolodex is for that. So however you want to do it.
Sure.
I'm trying to stay as far away from hammering on your list as possible is all.
That's fine.
Okay. So I kind of wanted to jump in because I from something you said earlier, I don't think you'll really see these as it's certainly not the type of improv you do, but it's, mm-hmm. you know, popular improv heavy.
That the listeners would.
TV shows, except for one. We could obviously pick like any Christopher Guest movie. Was Best in Show beyond like the first one that he did like entirely?
I don't know. I know that like they certainly like will probably shoot. They have such gifted character actors. I'm sure they just shoot and shoot and shoot. But I don't know how much of it is structured. Like what percentage, like if it's an 80-20 or yeah. something. I'm not entirely sure, but that one, obviously that Mighty Wind, like those are all like notoriously like improv heavy.
Yeah. Perfect. So let's just, when I think of it, I love Spinal Tap, but I don't think he like, he didn't direct that or something. Or probably Rob Reiner did.
Rob Reiner.
But so let's go Best in Show. That's kind of what I think of as that kind of era of comedy. Yeah. Let's go. You mentioned it earlier about as pop as improv gets. Whose line is it anyway? And then let's go with what from everything I hear conflicting reports, but every time I deep dive on it, it definitely seems improv heavy. Curb. We're in actually. Yeah. Curb. Yeah. Here we go.
There it is.
Yeah. All right. The OG, I'm going to say that like that character driven monologue, like cutaway documentary style, which is like so embraced by basically every sitcom now, is like, for me, that's going to be like the Fantôme, because it's something from like the 80s or 90s mm-hmm. that's been around, like farmhouse ales. Like it's not something that like, that is super novel, like that just came out. There's a lot of comedies that leverage that, but then like suddenly you get like The Office and people are like, oh, saisons. Like I always thought, you know, saisons were bubble gum and banana and clove, you know, like that was like their conception of them. And then now you like, you get modern, like, you try and serve someone saison modernly, they go, oh, a sour. Like that's like their immediate, like, because that's like how our modern sitcoms are, where it's like, if you watch like Modern Family, like there's a testimonial in every sitcom. There's a testimonial in every, like reality yeah, yeah. show, you know? So I think it kind of bridges both of those gaps. Yeah. In terms of whose line is like crisp, succinct. You don't need any background. It is just self-contained. And I think that is like Live Oak. That's like mm-hmm. the pre-war pills. Just in that, they don't need to understand that they're making it up or any of the complexities or like, oh, that's actually a reference to this. Or it's just like, you plop it on, people see Wayne Brady, it's a crowd pleaser. Like, sure, there's a ton of work and there's like years and years of nuance and stuff like that. That Ryan Stiles, like you're not just able like short form games like that. But for like, if you're middle America type of guy who like watches Tyler Perry films, like you'll like watch that and go, that's crazy. He's an alligator at the dinner party. That's great. You know, like, so that would be that. And then in terms of Curb is so interesting because like it's so character driven and it's conflict driven.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah. It is. Like,
and usually like to have such good conflict, you have to write it because it's like, it's going to turn on people's reactions to this or make like inevitably making things worse, like and escalating the situation. Yeah. Like I think that, for me, that reminds me of like the Private Press Electric Roads, because like Brad Clark is doing basically the same thing that he was doing at Jackie O's, like where it's like traditional cask driven, like air quotes thin relative to what some like modern palates would say, in the way that Curb is doing this like improvisational, often like two person scenes where they're conflicting, like that's not unlike a lot of like 1940s like acts yeah. where there's like a straight man and then there's a character who's mucking it up, like, you know.
And Larry David loves that shit. I mean, it's talked about in the yeah. show all the
yeah,
time
yeah.
It's the purest, like most boiled down, like comedy is conflict, like, you know, pain plus time equals comedy. Like all of those bromides about like what makes people laugh is kind of like Brad Clark is like throwing it back to old school types of beers that could have been like the best versions of like a barrel aged barley wine from, you know, like Fish Brewing in the early 2000s. He's doing like a crazier version of that, or like, you know, he's doing like a much better version of 05 Wooden Hell. Like it's in that way. It's like he's recognizing the core components and then just exaggerating them for like modern palates.
Wow.
So yeah,
well done, baby.
expectedly. Yeah. Excellent. Yeah, this is awesome, man. Thank you so much for doing this. As truly always a pleasure to get a dose of your perspective. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Thanks, man. Honestly, thank you for having me.
That was a blast.
Anytime.
We'll see you next year sometime around Christmas.
But yeah, man, you kind of know the drill. But till next time, man, great talking to you.
Congratulations on being a dad.
I'm in the mood to be slow.